This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the redwood forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lafitte, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio, filling in for Bassem Afarhat. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also log into our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Pal Talk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. We broadcast 1 hour live to the USA, United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. If you have questions for our guests, you can call 415-762-1160 or 712-432-0075, access code 318-116. You can also get those phone numbers from our website. You can also listen and call via your smartphone, so you will never have to miss the best guests on Internet radio. Tonight, I have with me Dr. Paul Larudi, the fifth American passenger on the Gaza flotilla in May, that we've had the pleasure of talking with here on People Speak. Hello, Dr. Larudi.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Jeanette.
Okay, and we said earlier, I'll just call you Paul for simplicity. Now, Dr. Larudi, you have a rather extensive resume in the Middle East, but I understand your primary occupation at this time is as a piano tuner, which, as we get into the show, you can explain to us how your injuries were concerning in relation to your profession. Now, I ask the same question of all the Americans that were on the flotilla, because one of the things we're getting back through the media is that the people there were naive, they have no understanding of the situation. They had no understanding of the risk, and I can see from the resumes of the people I've talked to that that's just not true. So could you tell us why, first of all, you chose to be a part of the flotilla?
Well, first of all, this is not my first time in an Israeli jail or in confrontations with Israeli. I've been wounded by Israeli soldier gunfire, and I've been beaten before, and so this is not unexpected, nor is it anything new in my case. But I think all the people who went there were prepared for the worst. So I'm no different in that respect. And it's because of the commitment they have. And if you think that this sort of thing discourages people, my colleagues with the European campaign, which hasn't even advertised.
Okay, sorry for that brief interruption. So,
my apologies.
Paul, so where we were interrupted you at, you were explaining that everybody there was well prepared and that this increases their commitment rather than discourages them. So
exactly. Now, of course, a lot of your listeners know that in 2003, Rachel Corrie, who was one of the volunteers in the International Solidarity Movement, was killed by a bulldozer in Gaza. And I checked with our person in charge of processing new volunteers, and the number of applications quadrupled after that. So you can't pretend that people who are now volunteering, and there are more than 9,000, perhaps 10,000, who've already volunteered for the next flotilla, that they don't know the consequences. They've all seen the consequences, and yet they're willing to come. Why? It's because of their commitment and because they realize that they can accomplish something.
Okay, so I'm going to take this question with you one step further because of your long-term commitment to Palestine. Why Palestine? We hear, and I hear this question a lot, there's so many issues going on in the world, so many tragedies, Chechnya. Why not the Kurds? Why Palestine?
there are many tragedies in the world and many injustices that deserve a lot of attention. The problem with Palestine is in many ways. First of all, it has been around for at least 62 years, and it is not getting better. It is only getting worse. Secondly, it is the largest recipient. Israel is the largest recipient of foreign aid. So the United States is more responsible for what is happening to Palestinians than in most places in the world. Third, the contrast between what is actually happening in Palestine and what people think is happening there is the greatest in the United States. All it takes is for people to go over there and see for themselves, and they come back, many of them, with a burning desire to make a difference and to tell everyone that it's not what they think. So all of these, and there's one more, a fourth one, which is that Palestine, as even David Petraeus, the commander of the Central Command, in which covers most of the Middle East, has said, it is at it's an important, extremely important factor in making problems for the United States there. It United States policy is, and U.S. relations with countries throughout the Middle East and indeed throughout the world are jeopardized because they are not neutral and because they are not following a just policy with respect to Palestine. They are not defending Palestinian rights.
Okay, now, for me personally, would you also, and I discussed this with Ambassador Peck, given the stated reasons for the attack on 9/11, given our lack of neutrality in brokering peace in the Middle East, in dealing with the various governments in the Middle East that are opposed to Israel, do you foresee that this, if nothing is done, could bring about further 9/11s within the USA?
It's very possible. I mean, they powerless people will try to find means to express their power. And when other means are unavailable, they will seek drastic measures when they perceive a great injustice. 9/11 might be an expression of that, even though most of our those who are critical of U.S. policy in the Middle East do not approve of 9/11. There's George Marshall, who was the Secretary of State under Harry Truman. When Harry Truman recognized the State of Israel soon after it was created in 1948, Marshall asked him, there was a lot of debate in the cabinet, and he was opposed to doing this. And he said, why do we need Israel? Truman said, it is to defend us from our enemies in the Middle East. Marshall responded and said, Mr. President, before the creation of Israel, we had no enemies in the Middle East. And this is a large part of the problem. It is Israel that is creating the problems, not solving the problems.
Okay. And now, when you were on this ship, now you've had previous experiences. You've been a member of IFM. I'm reading here that you've been in Palestine at least four different occasions on behalf of IFM. And prior to that, you were also in southern Lebanon to organize nonviolent resistance to the last Israeli invasion there. How does this experience in any way stand out from other experiences when you've come up against the Israelis and the IDF?
Well, the most amazing thing to me, as I came out from this enclosed bubble that we were in when we were imprisoned in Israel, because they didn't allow us to have any kind of contact with the outside world, even the kinds of contacts that other prisoners had there. It was unexpected from my part that there was so much U.S. media attention. This is important. And furthermore, a recent survey commissioned by a Republican poll taker shows that the American public does not believe the Israeli story, which is a little absurd, but a lot of people seem to believe it, and nevertheless it didn't sell well, which is that Israeli commandos, armed to the teeth, but nonviolent, went into the middle of the Mediterranean and encountered unarmed human rights volunteers, but violent, unarmed but violent human rights volunteers, and were beaten up by them. This is the story that's being told, and I'm very pleased that the American people, by and large, are smart enough to see through it.
Okay, now, they make a big issue to some extent that the only problems occurred on the Mavi, that all the other ships basically surrendered with minimal resistance, there were no injuries, and we've been told by the other members on your ship that that's not entirely true, particularly in your case. Do you feel, first, that you were targeted particularly by the Israelis, the IDF coming on board? And to what degree were you injured?
I really don't know. But what you say is true, that there were the Israeli commandos attacked people on all six ships. We were fortunate that nobody was killed on the other five ships, but that doesn't mean that we weren't attacked, and it doesn't mean that we didn't put up resistance. There was resistance on all of them. There were people on my ship who were hurt worse than I was. But as you may know, I left the ship fairly early on. I jumped overboard.
Go ahead.
I jumped overboard after being beaten, and my fellow passengers came to my defense as that happened. And essentially, they didn't rush up to encounter them, but encounter the commandos. But they did shout, and the commandos left me at that time. And then afterwards, I decided that I would jump overboard as a means of slowing down the operation. And it did. It forced this ship to stop for a while, and it forced another ship, an Israeli Navy ship, to come by and pick me up. And I just felt compelled to resist however I could, nonviolently, of course, but nevertheless to not to cooperate to the degree that I could.
Well, I'll tell you honestly, I followed the flotilla from before at time at Leftport. I've had an interest in Palestine for a long time. I won't go into that. But I'd heard about the death. I got up Memorial Day morning, and the first thing I did was check the news and heard about the death and the horrible news coming out. But one of the bright flashes in all of that news, I actually got a laugh when I'd heard that you jumped overboard to slow down the Israeli operation. Something as simple, I could see them running around trying to fish you out of the Mediterranean. Now, and it was a brilliant move if they all could have swam. Like I said, I have any number of questions. I'm checking to make sure I don't have any questions from the audience just yet. You were on the ship. You were in previous incidents in Palestine. Back in 2002, you were helping during the major onslaught then. I have reason to remember that. That was the year in Jenin as well. You weren't in Jenin. You were
in Nablus. No.
Nablus. Okay. And so at that time, of course, the justification for the increased violence against the Palestinian was the suicide bombers. But at any time, you know, let people know what you've seen there among the Palestinians. And especially if you can address them, because you've had extensive experience there, the constant accusation that the Palestinians are taught to hate Jews and that they want to destroy all Jews.
There are so many exceptions to that, counterexamples to that. I remember, for example, a dear friend of mine, Dorothy Naor, who is American-Israeli, and she, when she was able, she's pushing 80 now. I don't think she'll mind me saying that. And she's just not able to go there as often. But she was in a demonstration and smelling the tear gas and all that sort of thing. And after it was all over, one of the Palestinians said, "Please, can you come to my house?" And he said, she said, she thought this is Palestinian hospitality, the usual thing. And he said, no, you really, I want you to come because my children have never met an Israeli that they can call a friend. They only know Israelis as soldiers and people who do bad things here. I used to work in Israel. I have a relationship with people. I have friends in Israel. So I know better, but my children don't. So if you would come, we can show them that there are Israelis with whom we can be friends. So this is an example of the kind of teaching that they get to them, and I've seen even when Israeli soldiers were breaking the furniture in a house and turning the house upside down, the elderly woman goes into the kitchen and fixes tea and says, let's sit down and have tea to soldiers who are damaging her house. I mean, there are just so many. These are anecdotal. I agree. It doesn't indicate a trend, but it's a mistake. You know, the Palestinians are portrayed as anti-Semitic. Palestinians have resisted. They don't care whether the people who are occupying them or expelling them are Jews or Muslims or Christians. They resisted the Ottoman Muslims that were occupying them. They resisted the British Christians that were occupying, and now they're resisting the Jewish Israelis that are occupying them and even expelling them, which is something new. So this has nothing to do with whether they're Jewish or whether there are anti-Semitic feelings among Palestinians. It has to do with the fact that they are being expelled. There's a worldwide population of approximately 11 million Palestinians. 8 million of them cannot live in their homes in Palestine. They cannot. They're forbidden by Israel to live in their homes in Palestine. The remaining 3 million are under occupation, and Israel is working hard to expel them. That's what this is really all about.
And so then, when I get that question, the answer is no. The occupation teaches hatred.
Exactly. Regardless of what you teach them, it's the experience that they have that teaches them.
Now, when I was researching for the interview tonight, I ran across something interesting. It's the Stop ISM website, and they're incredibly hostile to you in particular. They had you on there by name, and they've expressed a clear intent to see you put in jail for your activities on behalf of the Palestinians. Are you aware of these intentions?
Oh, yes. This is the website of Lee Kaplan, who makes it a personal crusade, although he's not alone. He has others who feel equally strongly and work with him. And he has he's actually publicly said that he will help the Israeli authorities to kill me. And he has had at one time put a $20,000, essentially a bounty, on the heads of ISM volunteers. What he said was that during the invasion of Gaza, if anyone would provide him with the exact location of one of the ISM volunteers, he would pass that on to the Israeli authorities so that they could target that location. That was eventually removed, as the people did complain to the web host, and so the web host took him down. I've forgotten what website that was, but that's the sort of thing they do.
Yeah, I've encountered that before. Another one, are you familiar with, and this is directed at Israelis or Jewish people who stand up against Israel, It's and you'll find it under this, the Self-Hating Israeli Traitor List.
Oh, yeah.
And my reading of it, it's literally a hit list on Jewish people who disagree with Israel.
Oh, right. Well, they put an F in front of it, which we can't say on here. But yes, that's essentially what it is. I have to say that even the Zionist Jews don't want much to do with Lee Kaplan and these really extreme types. Let alone the ones that care about justice for Palestinians, such as the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network and Jewish Voice for Peace, groups like that.
Yeah, and there's many groups like that, and they're growing.
Yeah, and very much so.
One, Not In My Name. Are you familiar with them? Okay. Also, a young woman that was interviewed, I didn't do the interview, the Shministim. Have you met any of the young people from the Shministim out of Israel, the 12th graders who refused to join the IDF?
Yes, I've gone to one of their presentations, and I know one of the graduates of that too. What they're doing, of course, they're really being ostracized by their own society, and they're taking a very brave course of action.
Okay, now obviously you haven't let these threats interfere with you. Are you aware of people who are taking extra precautions in light of these threats from the extremists? Because extremists tend to link up with extremists everywhere. And
yes, I don't know. I think most people who receive these threats eventually, if not immediately, just don't want to rule their lives or their actions, and so they just take it as a matter of course. In most cases, those threats are just talk. But it is possible that some of those threats might be a danger, and it's always a good idea to report it to the authorities so that you have something on record. I can't say that I've always done that, but I should.
Okay, now I also went through the Free Palestine Movement website. This is an organization you helped found?
Yes, that's correct.
And that it's not the flotillas are not the only project that you have planned to support the Palestinian people. I'm seeing here on the list the Return from Exile Project, Gaza by Air, Concert for Palestine. Would you care to fill in on any of those other activities and whether they're advancing or going to actually develop and be put in motion?
Well, in some cases they're advancing, in some cases you could say there's delay. And but it's encouraging either way, in a sense. Because, for example, the success of the flotilla, and it's a relative success, obviously the success could be considered, the criteria would be to get into Gaza. Well, we didn't get into Gaza, but obviously the flotilla had a great impact, and that's perhaps equally important, perhaps even more important. And people are determined enough, and groups are determined enough around the world to try to continue to do the same action. It's good to try to do the same action, but it seems like every time we do this, we end up with ships being confiscated in Israel. In other words, it's going to be a very costly action. If there are parties that are willing to incur those costs, we're willing to continue to try to do it that way. But also, it's, I think, an advantage not to keep doing the same things over and over, but to come up with new ideas. So some of the new ideas that we have in mind are to fly an airplane into Gaza, which, believe it or not, is eminently practical. And so this is taking it to a new dimension, if you will. We also, the Return from Exile project is intended to look at a different aspect of this. Most of the efforts are around Palestinians who are living under occupation. Well, the Palestinians who are living under occupation and in Israel amount to less than half of the Palestinian population, because more than half, the majority of Palestinians, are not living in Palestine. They're living in exile as refugees in refugee camps in the surrounding countries and simply around the world in Latin America, Australia, North America, and so forth. So what about all these people who can't even go to their homes? Our idea is that we get, let's say, for the sake of argument, 100 Palestinians who have citizenship in other countries and in from various cities that fly on commercial flights into Tel Aviv all on the same day in order to assert their right to return. They'll say, when they're asked, what is your purpose in coming to Israel, because that's the way it's presented, I want to go to my home. Where's your home? And then the rest of the story ensues. Of course, it needs a lot of media backup for this in terms of planning and having support committees in both in Palestine and in the country from which they came, and maybe having journalists on board the aircraft and so on and so forth. I mean, it's a whole operation, but the idea is to dramatize the fact that Palestinians cannot go to their homes. So, and then a concert for Palestine, we were inspired by the 1988 concert for Nelson Mandela, where Nelson Mandela, in prison, was given a concert on his 70th birthday. This took place at Wembley Stadium. 100,000 people attended. There were all sorts of huge names that participated in this, and it raised awareness and it raised money, and it became part of the popular culture. We think we're reaching the point now where a popular concert for Palestine could achieve the same result and be broadcast to millions and millions of people around the world. So we're trying to make that happen and get the big names to participate in doing this. So there are other ideas. There's another idea which we haven't yet adopted, but it's out there, to create a picket line at sea. We're calling the people who are proposing it are calling it a sail-in, to invite people who have small boats, whether they're fishing boats or pleasure boats or, you know, yachts and sailboats and so forth, all to come without going to Gaza. Instead, we're just remaining in international water, not breaking the Israeli security zone or anything like this. In other words, Israel will have absolutely no excuse to stop these people. And yet they might get closer to Gaza than we did. We were 80 miles away, and they could, in theory, be 30 miles away and not a threat to the security zone or you know, no possibility of entering the security zone. And if we get enough to keep coming, we could have several dozen of these out there for maybe months at a time. And we'll have a couple of boats with ships with journalists and maybe tankers with that can resupply these boats with fuel and so on and so forth. Just have something in the middle of the sea, a sit down strike at sea, basically. So I mean, there's no end to the kinds of things that we can dream up, and I think we are in a climate now where people are ready to do this kind of thing.
Okay, now, Dr. LaRuiter, we're going to take a very short break here, and then when we come back, I have questions stacking up from the audience. Most of them are coming to me via text, so I will read them to you.
Okay.
Don, are you here? I'm waiting for Don to get... But in the meantime, so we also want to talk about what vision you would see for Palestine in the future. We're not being... I don't think Don picked up the cue, so I guess we're just going to go ahead. Let me go ahead with some of these questions, and if Don breaks in on me, I'll know. From Susan in New Hampshire, could you tell us what the Israelis did to you when you were taken into custody on your ship? Were you treated well? Well, you have kind of rather answered that. But
there is more than I could add to that, though.
Okay.
I was, when I was picked up, first of all, I was beaten before I ever jumped off the boat. But then I was beaten after I was picked up as well. And then there were several more times after I got to court, especially when I had when I demanded that they provide me with a pair of pants that, that didn't have a long gaping hole that had been created during my some of these beatings in a very strategic place, and down the front of these pants. And I said, I need a new pair of pants. Well, they beat me even harder, then slammed my head against the concrete, kicked me in the head, kicked me in the ribs, twisted my limbs, and so on and so forth. And there was there were one or two times after that, especially at the airport on departure, because they were trying to force me to go to Istanbul rather than to Greece, and I had been invited by the Greek government to be on that flight, which is something that I'm not sure why the Israelis wanted me to not to go on that flight and insisted on me going to Istanbul. But I think it's because in Istanbul, the story was, of course, the nine dead Turks, which they deserve that story. But my going to Greece, because I was the subject of a previous documentary there, I'm well enough known that journalists will crowd around me and take pictures, and this is a picture that the Israeli government would not like to see. So all of these occasions, I resisted, and they beat me up again. And as they were beating me, 30 or 35 of my fellow prisoners came to my defense, and some of them got beaten up worse than I did, with broken bones and. Which I didn't have, and so these are all part of the treatment, mainly because I refused to cooperate. So now I'm not saying, you know, there were probably at least 50 people, maybe more, who received worse treatment than I did. Obviously, the people who were shot and the people who were killed are vastly more more than I got. But it's just illustrative of the, how shall I say it, the treatment that was being given.
Okay. Now, I have a similar question, because, and you partially answered it. Mike wanted to know why the Israelis beat you. Did you insult them? Did you give them reason to believe you were going to attack them? It was simply the resistance.
No. I was totally nonviolent, but I was also totally uncooperative, in the sense that I wouldn't even walk to, in many cases, to do what they wanted. They had to carry me, and they resented that. And I wouldn't talk. At the beginning, I refused to talk or even look at them. And so all of these types of non-cooperation were they tried to use pain in order to force me to do things like to get up and walk to a particular location, and so that's basically it, actually.
Okay.
Or for example, I would insist that I had to have some that I had a right to bring with me the clothes that they tore off the shirt and pants that they tore off me and replaced with their own clothes. I said, those are my clothes. I want them. And when I insisted, they said no. And I said, well, I'm not going anywhere. And I sat down on the floor and let the body go limp. And they had to carry me. And they started to twist my arms again, in some cases to beat me. So this is how it happened. I refused to cooperate.
Okay, now I have a question from Steve in the UK. I understand you are a student and now a colleague of Professor Noam Chomsky. Is Professor Chomsky supportive of your efforts, and will he perhaps be joining you in the future flotillas?
Well, I can tell you that he's been very supportive of not only the efforts that the Free Palestine Movement but also lots of similar efforts. He has been very encouraging towards this type of nonviolent resistance movement. Whether he will be joining us, I can't say. I think it depends on the availability of his time. And because he's not a young man, I think it's fair to say that, it has to be something that doesn't jeopardize his health as well and that he's capable of doing.
Okay, now let's see. Mike from Australia. Now, has anybody ever found out how much of the aid that was in the convoy actually reached Gaza or how much was stolen by the Israelis?
Well, I personally don't have a handle on how much. It's my understanding that, well, first of all, most of the aid that was in the convoy was intended to help rebuild the structures and the housing that was destroyed in the incursion into Gaza in late December 2008 and January 2009. And it's my understanding that none of that has gotten in, and that was the majority of it. But, for example, the scooters for the handicapped and the wheelchairs that I saw loaded onto the Greek ship in Athens, that was first taken to Gaza, but the batteries had been removed, so they were totally useless, and they were rejected by the authorities in Gaza for that reason. And so finally, after some negotiation, it's my understanding that the Israelis did replace the batteries, and they did enter Gaza. So there are some things that apparently did get in.
Okay, now, from Alice in Washington, what are the status of flotillas to Gaza? Do you know which countries are sending them in the future and when they are going?
The current plan is that the flotilla will sail in late September or more likely in October. That is the plan, but of course plans change according to circumstances. And they are the places from which they're coming. I'm really not certain. I was at a meeting in Beirut a little over a month ago where lots of countries pledged that, and we need some updates on that from some of the participants in that meeting. But the group is called the International Committee for, I think it's Freedom of Palestine and the Breaking of the Siege on Gaza. And this, there are, we're hoping to have maybe two or three times as many ships, 10, 20. There have been talks of ships up to 60, although we can't be certain that they would all leave at the same time, that are interested in going. So I think it'll be rather impressive when it happens.
Now, I'd heard a rumor of the effort to get an American ship, an American registered ship with entirely American passenger list into a flotilla. Have you any information on that?
This is the group, it's a coalition calling itself U.S. to Gaza. They have a newly opened website, which is U.S. to Gaza. The Free Palestine Movement has attempted to endorse that and to participate, but so far that hasn't happened.
Okay, now from Dave in New Jersey, to what extent beyond bombardment is Israel thwarting the establishment of a viable Palestinian economy?
Well, I think that's one of the weapons that's being used by Israel to destroy Palestinians. In the case of Gaza, the means is fairly obvious. It is to block all functioning of the economy. The one thing that people often fail to observe is that Israel is not allowing any exports from Gaza. Now, there's no security threat from exports. You know, they're worried about rockets and guns and arms going into Gaza, But what's the security threat on stopping exports? Well, what's happening there is that Israel is shutting down the economy of Gaza and essentially making everyone dependent on food aid and just if they want them to barely survive. Dov Weisblas, the advisor to the prime minister, famously said, and I think this characterizes the strategy, that he wants to put Palestinians on a diet. Well, Palestinians were already pretty thin, and what he wants to do is to make them thinner. And it's really a very cruel kind of policy. But they're doing the same thing in the West Bank to a large extent. The Palestinians are, in some cases, have to do extreme water rationing. So that I personally saw even in 2002 that Palestinians in some areas would save dishwasher. They could never bathe. But they would save dishwasher in the summer. They would use that to flush the toilet at the end of the day. They wouldn't flush the toilet all day, and they would flush the toilet at the end of the day. You know, it's this kind of thing, and they would have to get rid of the animals, slaughter them or sell them, because they couldn't give them water and they had no agriculture. It's just, you know, it's this destruction of the entire economy. Israel doesn't know how to do anything else except to make life as miserable as possible, hoping that Palestinians will leave. But they have always underestimated the tenacity of the Palestinians and their bond with the land.
Okay, now, question from Don in Oregon. What can people sympathetic to the cause of the peacekeepers trying to break the Israeli blockade and help the people of Gaza donate other than money? What can an unemployed person in Tennessee or North Dakota with $2 rope get together do to help the cause of liberation for Palestinians?
Oh, that's a great question and much appreciated. Yeah, to the extent that people can offer time, and everybody can write letters to newspapers and to members of Congress and this sort of thing. And I know there's plenty of reason to be cynical about writing to members of Congress or even to newspapers in a lot of cases. But it all counts. It all makes a difference in the long run. And if you have skills that you can contribute to organizations that are working on these projects, such as, computer skills and websites and so forth, that's always greatly appreciated by the organizations involved.
We have a caller on line one. Caller on line one.
Okay. We've got a caller for you on line one. Go ahead, caller. Name and location first.
Yes, hello? Hi. My name is... Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Hi. My name is Tofka, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Dr. I'm really glad that you're here, and congratulations on your courage and tenacity. I totally admire what you've done and everybody on the flotilla. I have a question. Were you at any time after you were in Israel or while you were in Israel or even when you arrived in Turkey, were you ever in touch with the U.S. consulate or embassy or any U.S. officials? That's what I would like to know. And if you did, what did they say? Thanks.
Yes. Now, in my case, I was never in Turkey. I went to Greece instead. But the U.S. consul general did come to meet me in Israel while I was in prison. And I was in a different prison from most of the rest of them, but he came there. And the reason the consul general is because my congressman, George Miller, interceded on my behalf. And this is very important. If we can get the members of Congress to help and to show an interest, then it makes a big difference for those who are involved. So he did, and the result of that was that the consul general came to visit me, and that was a very important thing to happen. It brought a lot of attention.
Okay, now, I'm not picking up any more questions here from the audience, but I have two more that I'd like to cover before we go. One is the other members of the flotilla told us that all their personal possessions were confiscated, that the Israelis confiscated in excess of $500,000 of their personal possessions. Do you know if anybody ever received this back?
Well, of course, I've been mainly in touch with the passengers who were on the Svendoni, which is the second largest passenger vessel. That was the ship that I was on. And nobody, as far as I know, has seen any trace of any of the baggage or the electronic equipment that was on board, or even the journalists who lost their equipment. So all of that is still missing, and we have no idea where it is. Not even a trace of it has shown up in Istanbul, and the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv has no further information about it.
Okay, now, we know that Israel has refused an international investigation into the events on the Mavi and the interception of the flotilla. We do know that they've set up their own commission, an internal commission with a few outside observers, but in advance of that, they have released the military report saying that mistakes were made in planning and execution. How do you feel about the fact that this is not going to go through an unbiased investigation?
Well, I think that, in summary, the Fox has looked at the deeds that he performed in guarding the chicken house, and that he has concluded that he was perfectly justified, and that his major mistake was getting his mouth too close to the beak of the chicken that he was gently carrying between his teeth, and as a result got his beak pecked, his nose pecked by the chicken that he was carrying in his mouth. So that was probably one of the mistakes that was made. I have no confidence whatsoever in Israeli self-investigations, and nobody else should either. This is nonsense. And it's only an international investigation by an authority who has the reputation, like Judge Goldstone did, could conduct an investigation that anyone would seriously believe.
Okay. That pretty much covers everything I had particularly wanted to ask you about. Of course, the official report hasn't come out yet. I think everybody's expecting an investigation conducted, but it would be, I've heard it expressed as, well, that would have been like Manson investigating the Tate murders. Where do you see this going? Do you see any real changes occurring either in the level of the American government support for Israel, which has been blind to date, or the American public, or do you, like you said, you started going there in 1965. I became involved in 1981, and we've seen things go from bad to worse. Do we see any real chance of a turnaround anytime in the near future?
I have to say that I do. I do see a turnaround, and this is because, if you recall, in the anti-apartheid movement, The period just before apartheid fell was the worst period in South Africa living under the emergency laws that were passed in late 1987. And what we didn't realize at the time was that this was the last card that the apartheid regime had to play. And when it didn't work, the whole thing caved. Now, in the case of Israel, Israel is facing some very serious problems. A lot of their own population is leaving. We tend to forget that most of the immigrants to Israel did not come there because they were Zionists. They came there because they had poor choices about where they could go and what they could do, and they went to Israel because it was the best deal that they had. Well, now a lot of those immigrants are getting better deals somewhere else. They have the opportunity to seek their fortune in the United States or even back in Russia, where many of them came from. And so it's a better option for them to leave. A lot of them are leaving. It's estimated that perhaps up to 1 million of them have left in the last 6 years, let's say. And there are not large sources of immigration to Israel as well. So the demographic problem in Israel is going to become what they consider a problem. It's going to become worse. And the solutions to this are not so much to bring more Jews into Israel in order to create that. They're going to have to be even more brutal towards Palestinians in trying to expel them. But they're going to fail, I think, and this has been alluded to by many Israeli voices as well, and even Zionist voices, that they wonder about whether this experiment is going to succeed. Well, I think it's not going to succeed. And partly due to our own efforts, the more we do, and the stronger we are, and the sooner this is going to end, and Israel hopefully will go the way of South Africa, that they will peacefully say this experiment is not going to work. Let's give up on it.
Okay, Paul, we have 3 minutes left, and I have one last question from Steve again in the United Kingdom. His question is: if you accept donations from industries and economies which supply Israel, how can you credibly suggest that you oppose their atrocities?
Oh, I would accept donations from Israel itself. It doesn't mean that we take our orders from them, but if anybody is willing to support what we do, we'll definitely take their money. I mean, if AIPAC wants to send their money to us, we're happy to take it and use it the way we want. So the more support we get, the better.
Okay, and I have a question from Blue in Israel. Isn't the demand for the right of return to the Green Line Israel's contradiction to the idea of a two-state solution?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing here is not the number of states, but the behavior of however many states there are. And as long as individual rights are respected and people have the right to return to their homes and everyone is treated equally, that Jews are not favored over non-Jews or any population is favored over any other, if we don't demand that the population, a certain proportion of the population, must be Jewish, as we in California or the United States demand that a certain proportion of the population must be Anglo and not be Spanish-speaking or African-American or whatever. These are all racist notions. People should be allowed to live in the place that they consider home, regardless of whether they're Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, whether they're Arab, European, or whatever. They need to be allowed to fully use their realize their human rights, and this is the important thing, regardless of the number of states that are there.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Moridi. We are out of time now, and we do appreciate the extensive amount of time you've spent with us tonight in filling us in and the more detailed picture we're able to get as a result. We appreciate you coming, and we appreciate all our listeners for tuning into the People Speak this evening. Thank you all, and we'll see you next week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of the past, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, man. This yeah, this land was made for you and me.